The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Josh Pick is the chief investment advisor with Aptus Wealth Management, a state-registered investment advisory firm. This program is sponsored by Aptus Wealth Management. Exposure to ideas and financial vehicles discussed should not be considered investment advice or recommendation to buy or sell financial vehicle. This information should not be considered tax or legal advice. Individuals should consult with professionals to see if any ideas expressed would fit their specific situation. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. Securities can fluctuate and when redeemed may be more or less than when originally invested. Welcome to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick. Every week, Josh will teach you ways to help manage risk and protect your retirement income in the new economy. The primary focus at Aptus Wealth is to provide flexible planning strategies that can efficiently achieve your long-term retirement goals.
Thank you so much for joining us. You can hear Josh. I don't know if the listeners know this. Some of you are just tuning in. You can hear Josh every Monday at 6 p.m. with Bruce Hooley on 98.9 The Answer. It is called Money Mondays. And if you happen to miss Josh's visit with Bruce, you can listen to the podcast, which you can find at Josh's website, which is aptuswealth.com. Hi, Josh. Retirement savings and Social Security are what most people lean on for income during retirement. But are there other ways, or what are some other ways that retirees can generate additional income?
Certainly. The most common sources of retirement income are Social Security, pension, savings in the way of retirement assets, savings at the bank, et cetera. And then sometimes you'll have an ancillary rental property, et cetera. But there are other ways that you can derive retirement income, the most common being part-time work. We've talked a lot over the weeks about, finding purpose in retirement, and so sometimes that's difficult to find purpose. You retire, you've been getting up, going to work every day, and particularly during COVID now, your purpose might have been volunteer work, and maybe that's been taken away, or your purpose was getting out there and traveling, and that's been taken away. So purpose can be found sometimes and a part-time job, maybe from home, maybe out and about, but that obviously, drives income. So part-time work's a big one. And a lot of times I'll have conversations with people, Diane, and they'll say, well, I was making, $100,000 a year before. Part-time work's only going to, I'm going to make $800 a month or $1,000 a month. You'd be surprised how much $1,000 a month actually can move the needle for a lot of people. So part-time work's a big one.
Is there any ageism when people are looking for work and retirement? Are people finding it easy, or do they feel because they're of retirement age that they have a hard time finding a job?
It certainly depends on what you're looking to do for work. One of the common ones, I'll give you an example, amongst the gentlemen in my practice is, going and getting a job at a golf course or going and getting a job at Home Depot or Lowe's or something like that. But I even have people that are doing, they have a background in the construction area and they're doing, construction inspections. Well, I go do them kind of, they say, how many do I want to do? They assign them to me and I go do them. And it takes me a couple hours one day. I mean, there's a whole host of things. If you have a knowledge base, you'd be surprised if you kind of put some feelers out there and start looking around the jobs that are available to you that may be incredibly conducive to what you would in an ideal world like to do. So don't be discouraged or automatically jump to conclusions that I'm a certain age or, whatever your hang up is. Take a look. It might be of value to you. And the other thing that people find out very quickly is it's amazing how much you can love your job when you don't have to be there. How many times we feel like we're trapped in a job and we can't leave because we need the income. So we hate our job. We hate the fact that we have to go there because we have to. But when you're doing something part-time because you want to, the stress goes drastically away for a lot of people. So not saying you have to go get a part-time job, but a great source of extra income and potentially even more in the way of purpose and something to do in your retirement years on a part-time basis. The other one that people kind of tend to ignore because a lot of times we've had them for so long that we don't even pay attention to them is life insurance policies. Back in the day, not as common today, but back, 50 years ago, or 20 years ago, when, you know, 40 years ago, when I was young, everybody bought their kids life insurance policies and whole life insurance policies at that. Or, you know, I have people that have life insurance policies from 70 years ago, and they've been making these premium payments for years and years and years, and they know that they have a death benefit attached to that, and they know that somebody's going to get some money when they die, but maybe they don't want it, they don't want to pay for it anymore, or they do want it, but they didn't realize that it had so much cash value accumulated in here that we can actually use. Not only can we use it, many times it's a very tax-advantaged place to use it from. So oftentimes we can structure a life insurance policy to provide an income for people without paying any taxes on the income that's being derived. So life insurance policies are a great source. We need to take a look at those. One that we kind of tend to overlook as well, because it's gotten a bad name, is utilizing your home. And we used to call them reverse mortgages. Now they're called HECM loans, which just a fancy word for using your equity in your home for either income or a lump sum payment. And the way that those work, and I'm going to explain this very simplistically because they obviously can work in many different facets, but you take a loan out on your house. You never have to repay that loan. That loan can be taken out in the form of a lump sum payment, or it can be taken out in the form of almost like an annuity payment stream for the remainder of your life. You are absolutely allowed to live in your home for the rest of your life. Your home does not automatically go over to the institution that is loaning you the funds. In other words, you have a loan balance that you have not paid on, but your home has also hopefully been appreciating. Upon your death, your beneficiaries in turn sell that home, and whatever remaining equity is in the home, they still get. So I think one of the misconceptions, Diane, was that when you sell that home, when you take out one of these loans, you're effectively, you know, I get three payments of $1,000. I've only taken out $3,000. I die, and this greedy institution gets to keep all the equity in my entire home and sell the home at a great profit. Not the case at all. There is one downside of those loans, and the closing costs are usually much more significant than what you had been used to. But a great place, sometimes people's biggest asset is their home, a great place to get access to capital if necessary and still remain in the home that you want to be in.
And it's improved from back in the day because have laws changed or?
For sure. You know, it used to be kind of the, in every financial instrument that's created, it always kind of starts out as the Wild West. Somebody comes up with a great idea, then unfortunately people figure out a way to take advantage of it, and then regulators come in and change the game and make sure that it's a levelized playing field for all that's safe for consumers. And that's essentially the life cycle that these HECM loans have gone through. So now you don't have to worry about a wide variety of outcomes or, you know, that they're not regulated, et cetera, because they certainly are. I, you know, 20 years ago, I used to get calls all the time, Diane, that, you know, refer me people for one of these and we'll pay you $5,000 as a referral fee because the fees were so high. Fortunately, I never partook in any of those because it just wasn't part of my business model at the time. But for a lot of people, it makes a lot of sense now and it is heavily regulated, so you don't have to worry about that as much.
And there's also another way that people can generate additional income.
Another way that people don't necessarily know when they head into retirement is, you know, the government is a way. And the way that that can be done is when you have less income, you can potentially qualify for an earned income tax credit. So depending upon, and that's for caring for a child. So if you're in a situation where you are caring for a minor child, not only can you get tax credits for that, but if you're collecting Social Security, there's also a potential for you to get a Social Security benefit on that minor child until they're the age of 18. So I think, you know, there's a bunch of different avenues, but you need to know where to look and you need to know what your sources are. And that's really the advantage of working with somebody who operates in this space day in and day out. Is it's amazing how many scenarios you can run across in a year. And many of those scenarios are brand new. And you get to go investigate them, but then now they're in your wheelhouse for the rest of your life. And you're very aware of these types of scenarios. So I don't want to say I've seen it all, but I've seen a heck of a lot. And we can help guide you down the path of where those resources are available for you.
To schedule your own personalized planning session, give Josh a call at 614-364-7300. 614-364-7300. And the website is aptuswealth.com. Let's talk about Roth IRA conversion. And is it something more people should be looking into?
I think we should all look into it. but I think it's not applicable to all. And the difficulty with Roth IRA conversions is the industry wants to make it as simple as possible. Does it make sense? Doesn't it make sense? So let's create a calculator. And the calculators look a lot like this. What's your tax bracket? And you type in, my tax bracket is the 22% bracket. How much do you want to convert? $100,000. Okay, well then that's only going to cost you X amount of dollars. And it doesn't graduate with the way the tax code does almost always. And that really doesn't give you a justified response or a real response to the question. And the real response is this. We have to determine whether or not, first let me start back at the beginning. What is a Roth conversion? Roth IRAs are after-tax dollars that grow tax-deferred, and every nickel you pull back out of them are tax-free. So they're kind of the exact opposite of a traditional IRA where you put in money pre-tax. It grows tax-deferred, but every dollar you pull out goes into your taxable income. So the theory here is, can I convert some of my traditional IRA, pay the tax now, so that I pay less taxes in the future? And that argument is this. Am I going to pay less taxes now than I am in the future? And that's kind of a moving target because we don't know what the future holds. You know, elections happen. We just went through one. That changes the game. But things are constantly changing. But I think the overwhelming trend of what people believe is that moving forward, taxes will likely go up, not down. Now, we don't know how much they're going to go up. We don't know where tax brackets are going to be exactly. But we know that in general, and this is through stats, we believe the taxes are going to go up. So where should we convert to? And it comes down to a pain tolerance issue. If I'm at the 12% bracket now, and I think I'm going to go to the 18% bracket when, let's say, minimum required distributions kick in, should I convert as much as I possibly can at the 12% bracket to avoid some 18, 22, 24% bracket down the line? So the math here, Diane, is pretty simple, actually, and what math we should do, but you got to dive pretty deep in the weeds to figure out the answer, meaning that as an advisor, we have to take a look at your tax return. We have to take a look at your future income needs. We have to forecast what your minimum required distributions are going to be. But what a big benefit, Diane, if we could not only pay 12% in taxes as opposed to 22, but all the money that we saved, that 10% in taxes that we saved today, will forever grow tax-free, not just to us, but to our beneficiaries. Well, now we're talking about, it might seem like a subtle difference from 12 to, I mean, it's 10%. I mean, it sounds like a big number, but how big of a difference does it really make? It can be a monumental difference over the next 20 or 30 years. So should you be looking at a Roth IRA? 100%. But the question is, how do I analyze whether or not it makes sense for me? Now, I know when I say all of this stuff, it sounds very cumbersome and complicated, and I don't mean it to sound that way at all. It's something that we can do very, very quickly in a matter of one meeting and tell you if it makes sense. But we also need to revisit it because it's a moving target every single year to see if it continues to make sense. So it's not a set it and forget it plan. We have these meetings every single November, December with all of our clients, making sure that it's a right move moving forward.
If you have questions, give Josh's office a call at 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300. And hear Josh every Monday at 6 p.m. with Bruce Hooley on 98.9 The Answer. It's Money Mondays. And if you miss it, you can listen to the podcast at aptuswealth.com. We'll be back after the break with more.
We'll be back with more at the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick at 98.9 The Answer.
To create a successful retirement plan in today's economy, it takes a customized, solutions-based approach. At Aptus Wealth Management, founder Josh Pick calls it the Aptus Blueprint, and it's focused on managing risk instead of chasing returns. If you're working with another advisor or simply want a second opinion, put his team to work for you. To schedule a complimentary consultation to learn more about the Aptus Blueprint process, contact Josh at 614-364-7300 or visit aptuswealth.com. There is no cost or obligation, but space is limited. To start your plan, call 614-364-7300 or visit aptuswealth.com.
Thanks for listening to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Radio Show with Josh Pick. To schedule your complimentary customized planning session, give Josh a call at 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300.
Welcome back to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick. I'm Diane Brennan. Josh, I've heard big changes are on the way for Social Security in the near future. What do people need to know about how things will be different in the next year or so?
We don't know exactly what the changes are going to be, but we know what the problem is and we know what the potential solutions to it are. How that's implemented is really the question. So here's the problem. Social Security is, in fact, going to run out of money. And I know I feel like I'm beating a dead horse sometimes on this because I've talked about it so many times. But at the end of the day, we have a account that makes up for a shortfall for contributions, meaning people are working. They're contributing towards Social Security in the form of wage taxes. And there is a shortfall for the amount of people that are collecting based upon that contribution to wage taxes. So there's a think of it as a big trust fund. There's a big trust fund that's making up the difference. And that trust fund, depending upon which analysis you look at, is running out somewhere between 2030 and 2036-ish. So let's just say in the 2030s, 10 to 15 years from now, Social Security's trust fund that makes up about 20 to 25% of people's Social Security payments is going to run out of gas. So we know one thing. We either do something, or 10 to 15 years from now, 20 to 25% of people's Social Security payments are going to go away. It doesn't mean that you're going to lose all your Social Security payments, but it's certainly going to be reduced. Now, I don't believe that that's actually going to be the outcome. I think we're going to come up with a solution. It's what the solution will be. So here's some of the ideas that people are thinking about making at the political level. Raising wage taxes, reducing cost of living adjustments, increasing the amount of the top threshold of wage taxes, increasing the time frame in which you start to collect. So my full retirement age is 67. I oftentimes joke that my full retirement age is going to be 75. But I think that that will be a moving target. The one that's a little more terrifying to most when it's coupled with another one is one of the arguments is we're going to raise the wage taxes on the wealthy being people who make several hundred thousand dollars a year, but then in turn, we're going to eliminate the benefit. So we're going to do what we call means testing. And the argument here is Social Security was established to provide people a baseline of income to keep them out of poverty. Clearly, somebody who's made $400,000 a year shouldn't be in that position. So we're going to tax them more and then not let them collect anything on the backside of it. That's the one that, you know, tends to be the most terrifying is while you can raise it on those folks to not allow them any benefit seems to be kind of an issue that people take a lot of offense to. But we know what the issue is. We know what the potential solutions are. What we need to do is create some sort of bipartisan solution to this where we can all come together and come up with a justifiable, logical solution. But it seems like in today's environment, it's all or nothing, which turns into nothing. The other thing that needs to be addressed that seems to get skipped over is disability income. The disability, Social Security disability is a separate fund from Social Security retirement. And Social Security disability has been taking funds from Social Security retirement repetitively. It happened in 2015. It looks like it's going to need to happen again very soon. So we need to do an overhaul of how that process works as well. And that seems to be one that's just kind of getting kicked to the side while we use the retirement conversation first. But that is something that we're going to have to address the same way that we're addressing the retirement picture. But something needs to happen because just kicking the can down the line is just going to create a larger problem that needs addressed in a more dramatic way 10 or 15 years from now. So I hope we can come to a logical solution to preserve the people who are already collecting and preserve people moving forward that are going to retire 10, 15, 20, 40 years from now, preserve their benefits as well, because they will have been paying in their entire lives. I think they're entitled to some sort of benefit as well.
With the pandemic happening and all the assistance that people are getting and businesses, when you hear that on the news, do you know that Social Security is going to be affected or taxes are going to be raised? I mean, something has to change in order to make up for all the money that the government has been assisting the public with.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that a lot of people were furloughed from their employment certainly hasn't helped the Social Security issue. If less people are paying in via not having a job, not only is it a huge problem for the people that don't have a job, of course, and then we're exacerbating that issue by, you know, essentially providing huge stimulus packages, but that's also paying less funds into Social Security. So that trust fund that we were talking about is bleeding quicker. I think, you know, up until this point, the government's solution to this has been, we're not going to change anything. We'll just print money to fund it, which printing money to fund something is essentially taxation without representation to a certain capacity. Because when you print money, you devalue or debase the value of the currency, which is inherently lowering your value of the dollar. So, okay, we won't raise taxes, but we'll print a bunch of money. Well, if there's more money, more supply, that means that your dollars in your pocket are worth less, which is in fact taxing your dollars. So I hope, Diane, I really hope that we can come up with a solution that's based upon common sense, that's based upon, you know, what my parents called tough love. You know, I know it's not going to be perfect. I know you're not going to like it, but sometimes the medicine is bitter, but it's a pill we need to swallow. We need to make adjustments. We need to make changes. And that change isn't, you know, don't raise taxes, don't do things, don't fix the problem, don't readdress it, but just keep printing money so people's dollars are worth less.
And how long does it
that's
take?
That's not the solution.
How long does it take for the money to become devalued? Because a lot of people are thinking, well, just print more money, put it into Social Security. But how long do we see the effects of that money being printed?
Well, I'm not sure that we can answer that question in a matter of a couple of minutes, because there's a lot of other forces that are in play there as well. Because, for example, the demand for U.S. dollars has been pretty high. So we have a lot of foreign investment in the United States. When you have an increased supply but increased demand, they can kind of seemingly offset themselves. The big issue will be if we print money and there is less demand for U.S. dollars because other countries in the world either figure out their own interest rate scenario, or, I mean, there's a whole host of things that can happen. And this is one of many factors that's moving the needle on this topic. But to answer your question, I can't give you a definitive time frame, but it is a supply and demand issue at its core. And fortunately for the government, when they print the money and they spend it, it's going into the economy as the same value as your dollar. But then when it actually enters into the economy, that's when the supply goes up and the value of your dollar can potentially come down. I don't know how long that game continue to be played. Obviously, there's a lot of people playing this game at the top that are very smart, and the Fed chairmen, et cetera. But it's not a sustainable process. That everybody agrees is you can't continually raise a debt ceiling. You can't continually acquire debt. You can't continually print money. At some point, there's a call on that money, and that's where it goes the other way. It's kind of like, say you take out a credit card and you max it, and then you take out another credit card and you transfer the balance at a 0% interest rate. You have certainly kicked the can on the interest, right? But at a certain point, you can only keep on you can only keep on taking out more and more new credit cards at 0% interest. And at a certain point, credit card companies go, okay, great. Well, now you have, you know, $200,000 worth of credit out there on 19 different cards. We'd like you to see you pay off one. And that's when the house of cards comes falling down. And we've been doing that to the tune of $24 trillion. At some point, it cannot be sustainable. What that point is, well, that's the $24 trillion question, right?
Is the U.S. still an attractive place for foreign investment? Or do you feel with the political climate and the pandemic that it's becoming less and less desirable to invest money here?
Look, contrary to popular belief, and I know that, you know, in the media we hear that there are a lot of other countries that are better places to live, and we could debate that based upon healthcare, based upon school, or based upon whatever. But from a currency perspective, and from an investment perspective, and from an opportunity perspective, the United States is certainly one of the best countries in the world, if not the best country in the world. From a safety stance, we have the strongest military in the world. I mean, we could go on and on about the values of the United States, and I would consider myself a very strong, patriotic person in regards to the United States. I personally think it's the best place to live. And we can point to other countries in the world that have much bigger issues than we do. And those issues are driving them to invest in our country. So much so that you're seeing some restrictions being placed on it. China, for example, has so much investment in the United States and so much investment in Australia, for example, where Australia is actually limited how much they can invest in their country because they're driving up home prices from the amount of investment that they're putting in Australia. And we're seeing that, you know, in economies like New York City prior to the pandemic, where, you know, there was a lot of foreign investment, particularly from Asia. that's driving up those prices, because they have a much worse currency problem and interest rate issue in China than we do in the United States. So it looks more favorable to them right now. My concern is that those tables flip-flop while we continue to have this increasingly large debt. And believe me when I tell you, Diane, I'm oversimplifying this in a matter of 5 minutes.
Sure.
But it's a huge, huge concern, a huge concern that we can't overlook. You cannot continue to borrow money and print money indefinitely unless everybody else is just okay with it. And it's a matter of how long will they be okay with it.
So we as individuals, knowing what's happening globally, knowing what's happening with our country, it, for our individual purposes, it still boils down to planning for your retirement so that you can go through these ebbs and flows that we potentially
absolutely
face.
Constant education, constant planning. You know, if you're talking about your occupation, constantly be learning and making yourself more valuable to your employer. If you're talking about your retirement and financial picture, it's constantly improving upon your scenario, mitigating risk, improving your situation, making sure that you have your ducks in a row. It's just constant improvement, constantly be moving forward. If we can do that, then I think you'll weather the storm just fine if, in fact, there is a storm. But let's hope, Diane, that there isn't a storm. Let's hope that it's addressed. But you need to take these things into account when you're looking at your retirement planning picture. I'm always very hesitant, Diane, if you can't tell already. I think there's enough people in the world talking negatively enough, particularly in the media, talking about how everything's bad and prepare for Armageddon. You know, I have a lot of confidence in human ingenuity. And there's been a lot of things that have happened to our country over the last 100 years that I'm sure at the time felt like the end of the world. And we figured out a way to get through it. Sometimes the solution is something that there's no possible way that we could have predicted. I mean, who would have thought 30 years ago we would be carrying around all of the information that was in our Encyclopedia Britannica's plus a millionfold in a little device in our hand that carries all of our credit card information. It carries our music. We can watch movies on it. I mean, it's unbelievable what we have in our hand. There's no way we could have predicted that. And how many jobs and what economy has been driven by that is unbelievable. So I don't know what the solution will be. But I think if we make pragmatic decisions, both in Washington and on our home front, that the future will be very, very bright. So I want to address those. But we can't ignore stress testing our situation on the what ifs. We can't do that in retirement planning. We can't do it in our job planning. We can't do it anywhere. So my job, and hopefully what I can convey in the show, is what are some things that you can do positively to improve your situation, and how can we help make sure that you take steps forward and not take too many steps backward.
To schedule your own personalized planning session, the number is 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300.
Thanks for listening to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Radio Show with Josh Pick. To schedule your complimentary customized planning session, give Josh a call at 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300.
Welcome back to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Radio Show with Josh Pick. I'm Diane Brennan. Josh, let's talk about annuities. Would now be a good time to look into them?
Well, let's first talk about what an annuity is. I think there's two types of annuities, immediate and deferred annuities. And then amongst the deferred annuity category, there's a lot. But if we're talking about specifically immediate annuities are very much like a pension, meaning that I will give the insurance company a certain amount of money in a lump sum. And then in return, they will pay me a monthly income for the remainder of my life or for some specified amount of time. Usually the remainder of your life, and it's longevity protection. You can never outlive this bunch of money. The argument to those is that in today's environment of low interest rates, is now a great time to buy an immediate annuity that's going to pay out for the rest of my life that is essentially going to be calculated based upon today's low interest rate environment. And while I would say there's some validity to that, there's also some significant validity to making sure that you have an income stream that you can't outlive for the rest of your life. And will that give you the opportunity to maybe be a little more aggressive with some of your other assets. Beyond that, though, annuities are not affected purely in the same way as some other investments are from an interest rate perspective, because even though interest rates may fall, there's still a longevity calculator in there. So they don't fall necessarily congruently or equally with all investments just because interest rates fall. But let's compare them to our other options, because I think that's important. You know, people certainly like to badmouth all sorts of different ideas, but we have to compare them in a net-to-net perspective. So why wouldn't I be better off going and getting a bond, for example? Well, the problem with bonds is interest rates and bonds are inversely proportional, which means they go in opposite directions. So bonds have really benefited over the last 20 years or so from an environment where interest rates are constantly dropping. You know, we have 30-year mortgage rates at 3%, sometimes less than that right now. I mean, I can't fathom how they could go any lower than that. But every time I say that, Diane, they seem to go a little bit lower. But I think we're at a point now where we can't really go much lower. Interest rates are essentially at a wash. So interest rates, I would, you know, everybody kind of agrees they have nowhere to go but up. Well, as interest rates go up, bond prices should fall. So while bonds offer some stability in that they're not as risky as stocks and they provide income, you know, maybe I buy a bond and they pay me 4% a year in this bond. If I have a $100,000 bond that they're paying me 4% on, and now new bonds are paying 5%, if I need to get out of that bond, I'm going to get less than $100,000. So there's some risk there. There's actual measurable risk inside of bonds. There is no measurable risk inside of an annuity. Does a bond provide an income stream for the rest of my life, no matter how long I will live, whether I live to 80 or 180? Absolutely not. It does not. So there is some huge validity still to income generating annuities. Now, I spoke a lot, Diane, about, you know, immediate annuities, and the reality is not too many people do pure immediate annuities. What they do is deferred annuities. And deferred annuities is what you do before you turn on that income stream. And I think there is a huge case to be made for deferred annuities right now. And there's a bunch of different ways to do deferred annuities, but let's talk about fixed annuities in particular right now. There's two types of fixed annuities. One is just a pure, we'll pay you 4% guaranteed for this period of time. The other one is what we call a fixed indexed annuity. And a fixed indexed annuity allows you to participate to a degree in the performance of the market with no downside risk. And I know that sounds too good to be true. And maybe if we have some more time later in the show, I'll talk about how they do that. But you could get, you know, in many instances, 60, 70% of the upside of the stock market with no downside risk whatsoever. They also add in then these income riders, which means as long as I play by these rules for a period of time, let's say 1 year, 2 years, sometimes 10 years, then it'll provide an enhanced income stream for the rest of my life, sometimes adjusted for inflation even at a very significant rate, that I can't outlive. Well, why would that be of value? Right now, we just said we might be heading to a W-shaped type correction. Well, if that's the case, we've had a rebound now. We've rebounded from, depending on how you were invested, some, if not all, of your losses. Let's lock in back where we were now, still give ourselves some potential for upside, but eliminate all the downside risk. And then let's say we're 5 or 10 years out from retirement. Then we know when the retirement picture time comes, we can set up a guaranteed income stream for the rest of our lives that we cannot outlive with a portion of our money. Do we want to necessarily do that with all of it? No, there's some rules we have to play by. There's some liquidity issues, and we certainly wouldn't want to invest all of our eggs in one basket anyway. But it does add the safety and stability of a guaranteed income stream to your portfolio, which has huge value right now.
If people have questions, you can give Josh a call at 614-364-7300 and also to schedule your complimentary customized planning session. Again, the number is 614-364-7300. Josh, concerning annuities, I read something about financial strength ratings. Can you explain what that is and why it is important?
If we look back at what I just said, annuities provide guarantees, income for the rest of your life that you can't outlive. All of these things use the word guarantees. And those guarantees are only as good as the person providing the guarantee or the company providing the guarantee. So insurance companies are rated. They're rated just like the grades in school, A through D. Obviously, you don't want to invest in a D-rated company because you know, there's pretty good chance that if you're a D student in school, school wasn't your bag. Well, if you're a D student in the insurance world, you're probably not managing your assets as an insurance company very well. So step number one, go with high-rated insurance companies. And there are four major rating agencies. Most people only pay attention really to the big three, which is Fitch, Moody's, and S&P. But there's also an insurance, there's also a rating agency called AM Best. They all rate a little bit differently. You know, one will be A++ is the top rating, and then A+, and then A and A-, and so on and so forth. Others will be a double A, a single A, and then down through the line. Some will just be A+, A, A-, and so on and so forth. But it's important to note how and why they're rated the way that they are. If you're investing, an insurance company is essentially taking your money, investing it on your behalf in guaranteed instruments for the most part, and then giving you a fixed interest rate. So they're taking on some of that risk. If the insurance company is promising you a rate based upon taking on too much risk, well, then you're essentially taking on some risk there as well. So to be an A-rated company or better, you're regulated to a higher degree as to what, as an insurance company, as to what you can invest in. So if you're a B-rated company, you can be much more aggressive with your portfolio than you can be for an A-rated company, because they won't give you the A rating if you're invested that way. Well, in times of uncertainty, you could view that as a little bit more risk. The other thing that's important to know about insurance companies is they have to maintain a certain level of solvency. And that's a ratio that I like to look at, is what is an insurance company's solvency ratio. And solvency essentially means if everybody comes in and says, give me my money, do you have enough money to give them back? And, you know, we view banks with this air of solidarity and they can't go anywhere and they're great. Banks are regulated in a similar way. And I'll ask you, Diane, do you have any idea what the solvency ratio of a bank has to be?
30%.
You give them a dollar. 100%. You give them a dollar. How much do they have to, actually have, and how much can they loan out?
Oh, isn't it like, let's say 96 cents on the dollar?
It's pretty close. Yeah. They have to keep approximately 10 cents. So you give them a dollar. They loan out 90 cents. They used to be called savings and loans, right? So they give out 90 cents, and the way that they make money, outside of charging fees and all sorts of other stuff on accounts, the way that they make money is they loan out the money that you give them, charge somebody interest on the money that they loan out, and then they hope that everybody doesn't come in and give me all my money, because then they have a big problem. But they've done the actuarial calculation that not everybody's going to run in and say, give me all my money tomorrow morning. Insurance companies, on the other hand, cannot do that. They cannot loan out your money. What they are doing with your money is investing your money in essentially by buying bonds, etc. So if their solvency ratio drops below 100%, the state in which they operate, which does tons of audits, that state will come in and essentially shut them down. Now, banks are backed by FDIC. We all know that, you know, FDIC backs us to $250,000. So even if the bank goes out of business and we have $250,000 in the bank, we know we're going to get it back because the government essentially backs it up. They're backed federally. Insurance companies are backed by, not all of them, but most of them are backed by a system called SPIC, which is the State Protection Fund. So they are the same, at least in the state of Ohio, they're the same, $250,000 per contract. So if you were going to go, or per person, per company. So if you were going to invest $500,000, well, then it makes sense maybe want to spread this out amongst companies. But if you had $200,000 in some insurance company in the state of Ohio, and that insurance company subscribes to SPIC, then you would in fact be made whole. So the takeaways on why strength ratings are so important is, one, make sure you get one that's rated good by a third party. And essentially these rating agencies are like Consumer Reports of the insurance world. So get an A-rated company, number one. Number two, get one that's backed by SPIC in the state of Ohio, and not all of them are. And then number three, know that not all annuities are created equal. Make sure that you're getting the one that is best for you. So there's a lot of things to take into account. Make sure you speak with somebody who knows what they're talking about, and make sure you do your due diligence, because not everything is created equal by any means.
And you, of course, go over this with your clients.
For sure. I mean, this is part of our process. If an annuity fits the bill, which sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't, we want to make sure that we understand the ins and outs of both the insurance company and the product that we're talking about. Because like I said, not all of them are created equal.
If you have questions, if you'd like to see how the Aptus Blueprint process can work for you, the number is 614-364-7300. 614-364-7300. And you can hear Josh every Monday afternoon at 6 with Bruce Hooley on 98.9 The Answer. It's Money Mondays. And if you miss Josh's visit with Bruce, you can listen to the podcast at aptuswealth.com. When we come back, we're going to discuss why it's important your financial advisor is a fiduciary. We talked about this a little bit earlier in the show. We're going to dig a little deeper. I'm Diane Brennan. You are listening to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Radio Show with Josh Pick.
We'll be back with more at the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick at 98.9 The Answer.
To create a successful retirement plan in today's economy, it takes a customized, solutions-based approach. At Aptus Wealth Management, founder Josh Pick calls it the Aptus Blueprint, and it's focused on managing risk instead of chasing returns. If you're working with another advisor or simply want a second opinion, put his team to work for you. To schedule a complimentary consultation to learn more about the Aptus Blueprint process, contact Josh at 614-364-7300 or visit aptuswealth.com. There is no cost or obligation, but space is limited. To start your plan, call 614-364-7300 or visit aptuswealth.com.
Thanks for listening to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Radio Show with Josh Pick. To schedule your complimentary customized planning session, give Josh a call at 614-364-7300.
Thanks for joining us. We appreciate you spending time with us today. This is the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Radio Show with Josh Pick. I'm Diane Brennan. Josh, let's talk about fiduciary duty. What does that mean?
Well, first, fiduciary, you know, in the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission established a definition of what a fiduciary is in 2018 in response to a bunch of confusion as to what the best interest rule was for financial professionals. And I guess in a nutshell, what they determined was a fiduciary is essentially held to the highest standard and must act in the best interest of the client. And that's still probably pretty broad. But essentially what that states is that if you're claiming or you are regulated as a fiduciary, you are going to be held to a different standard, and you must, in all cases, hold your client's best interests at the forefront of every planning decision that you make. I went a little bit further to say that in addition to that advice, you cannot be paid disproportionately for any product or service, meaning that you know, if I have two choices to accomplish your objectives, fund number one and fund number two, or product number one and product number two, I have to base my decision based upon the merits of the product, and I cannot be paid 1% for one product and 2% for the other. It has to be a levelized playing field and fee-based exclusively. So commissions are out the window. That means that your decisions are being based upon the best interests and not based upon, you know, the advisor's best interests. And then that also incentivizes and requires, on top of that, the fiduciary to provide ongoing investment advice, meaning that this can't be a one-and-done relationship, which we've certainly seen a lot in the past of commission-based brokers, and I'm not begrudging anybody that was in the commission-based world. I know that most of us started that way because that's the way the world was back in the day, but there wasn't a lot of incentive to provide ongoing fiduciary advice to clients, because the only way that you really made money is by selling more products or additional products. So it just wasn't a good structure. Now, the problem is there's a lot of people still running around calling themselves, you know, financial advisors. And there was no definition of what is a financial advisor, what is a financial planner, what is, you know, everybody calls themselves all these different things. So it's very difficult from a client's perspective to determine, well, who is this person? Are they a financial advisor? Are they a financial planner? Are they an investment advisor? What does that mean? What do they do? So I think step one, Diane, is make sure that you're working with a fiduciary, because you know that by definition and by regulation, they simply have to have your best interests at the forefront of all their decision making. But sometimes it's difficult to figure out.
How does an advisor become a fiduciary?
Well, one, you have to take some tests, which is the case on the broker side as well. But two, it's how you're monitored. So I'll give you an example on our end. So we're a registered investment advisor in the state of Ohio. We get audited every year. That audit is pretty darn comprehensive. We got to make sure that we're not being paid disproportionately on anything. But the background checks are much more stringent. You have to have an educational background that substantiates your fiduciary title. You have to take ongoing continuing education requirements, and you have to take a little bit more stringent testing guidelines. And then on top of that, obviously, you have to comply with all audits and updated regulations. So it's just a more comprehensive process than the old brokerage model was.
And how can an average person find out if a person is a fiduciary?
Like everything in the world now, Diane, you go online. So essentially, you just Google, look up my investment advisor or look up my fiduciary, and it'll pull up a website. Some are essentially managed through the state that they operate. The closest, the easiest way in Ohio is look up Ohio Investment Advisory. Or an Ohio Investment Advisor lookup. And then it'll pull up and it'll say, enter in that person's name or business entity. And it pulls up and tells you, you know, how long have they been in business? A whole host of information. You'd be surprised how many people you can look up and find out that there's been a lot of thrown their way over the years. And you wouldn't know that unless you looked them up. So you can find out if has there been any complaints against my advisor. And then most importantly, because anybody can file a complaint, obviously, but what was the result of the investigation of that complaint? So unlike, you know, maybe consumer or not consumer reports, but Angie's List or some of these other things, you know, the Better Business Bureau, every single complaint that is filed against an advisor is absolutely investigated by the regulatory bodies. So you'll be able to see all of that on there.
If you have any questions, you can give Josh a call at 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300. That's also the number you can call to schedule your complimentary customized planning session. So when working with a fiduciary, and let's say there's a complaint against them, I mean, what is acceptable to an individual who's looking for an advisor? How does it work?
Well, I mean, I can tell you specifically for myself, I don't have any complaints, so that I can only speak for myself, but I think, you know, if I was looking for an advisor, and this is something I'll tell, you know, any client that walks through the door, you know, number one, you have to get along with the person that you're working with. We're going to spend a lot of time together, years and years and years. Your personalities have to be conducive to one another. So, you know, you can't be everything to everybody. That's number one. But you asked a question specifically about looking up the advisor and their qualifications. I would say number two, and I'm not picking on anybody that's new to the business, but I was new to the business once, and I'm sure you've been new to your business before, and you know, it just takes time. You have to gain some experience. So I personally wouldn't work with anybody that doesn't have a certain amount of experience. Now, what's my opinion on that? I would like to see somebody that's got industry experience of 10 years or greater. This is a big decision. You're literally entrusting them with your financial life for the remainder of your life. It's a big decision. Make sure somebody's not learning on the job. Make sure that they've got a lot of experience behind them. And then I personally believe, you know, if they have a complaint, maybe it's an erroneous complaint. What are the circumstances around the complaint? You know, was it resolved and they were found not guilty? You know, if they have a complaint, that's a judgment call. But fortunately, I don't have to have that that conversation, Diane.
Any other questions that the public should ask a potential financial advisor that you think are important?
I think they should be 100% transparent with how they're paid. The only way to know where people's motivations are, how do you get paid? If you want to find out very, very quickly if somebody is truly a fiduciary or just saying the right things, say, I want to see in writing exactly how you get paid. Every true fiduciary has to have a disclosure document that shows you exactly how much, when, and everything about how they're getting paid. It also tells you, in the event that I want to leave this relationship, what does that process look like? So we have a very thorough agreement that says exactly how we work with clients, exactly what we're getting paid, and exactly how we could dissolve this relationship should you choose. If they do not have that or cannot provide it or dance around it, you know something is not right. So that's absolutely make sure you can get your hands on that. You know, every good advisor, number one, I don't know what the stats are as to how many advisors actually do a planning process. I would kind of be terrified to look. I don't know how small that number is that actually do a true financial planning process. And by true, I mean taking into account the impact of taxes as it relates to minimum required distributions and Social Security as it relates to our other assets, et cetera, making sure that we take an approach of true diversification, not just kind of throwing some products on the wall and seeing what sticks, but how do we ladder the income streams for the remainder of our life and manage risk? I would be inclined to believe that that's probably a smaller percentage of the population than I would hope. But how do we differ? We take all those things into account. Our process is absolutely encompassing. We're not purely equity-based investors, meaning we don't just do mutual funds or separately managed accounts or ETFs. We don't just do insurance and annuities. We don't just do long-term care. We either do all of those things or we have experts in all of those areas where we consult with, you know, estate planning, et cetera. So I think maybe what separates us is our background as institutional side investors, and then also having the resources and the experts in all the areas to handle all of it, meaning taxes, estate planning, long-term care planning, income planning, the whole lot.
Let's talk a little bit about your background, Josh. When did you start in the business?
Yeah, I started in 1998, and I started in the insurance world. So my first place, and this is why I say experience is everything, the first place I started was a whole life insurance, we'll leave the name out, but a whole life insurance company. So, you know, as a young person starting out, you drink the Kool-Aid and every solution is whole life insurance because that's the arrow that I have in my quiver. And then I shifted to an equity-based company. So life insurance is out now. And now we go to everything is stock and mutual fund based. I then shifted out of the personal financial planning category, meaning that I was no longer working with individual clients. And for a few years, I was on the institutional side. So my clients were financial planners. And I did that for a number of years until about 2008. In 2008, I saw what was happening with the stock market. Saw the collapse, and I saw how we handled that on the institutional money management side and how we were able to manage risk and how individual clients were not able to do that because they were buying the same old products that they had always bought. So I shifted away from consulting to financial planners and institutions, and I shifted over to helping individual clients. A lot had changed at that time, too, that made it more accessible, like technology and the reduction of trading costs that made it, you could really bring the institutional money management level of risk management down to a client that maybe only had $100,000. And I'm by no means saying $100,000 isn't a lot of money, but institutional money management was only available to people that had, $5, $10, $15 million and up back in 2000, 2001. So a lot had changed. So it was a perfect marriage, a perfect time. And I'll never head the other direction. I love working with individuals and helping them accomplish what they want. It's the institutional side is a much more sterile based environment. You don't get to see the fruits of your labor, and you don't get to see people actually live out their dreams. You're kind of working with numbers all the time, and then those numbers somehow trickle down, but you don't get to see that side of it. So I like this end a lot better.
You founded the Aptus Group of Companies in 2003.
I did. Yeah, in 2003, I started the consulting company. So that company is still very much in business. We have about 600 financial planners that rely on us for up-to-date information, planning strategies, facilitate growing their businesses, managing a lot of things with their practice, all the way down to the financial planning piece of it. I still own half of that company, but it's managed by other folks now. I've stepped away, and now I purely work with individuals and have for the last 10 plus years.
I'm going to give out the number one more time because I'm sure those listening have questions. You can give Josh a call at 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300. Thank you so much for listening to this week's edition of the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Radio Show with Josh Pick. I'm Diane Brennan. Again, to learn strategies to manage risk in the new economy and to schedule your complimentary customized planning session, the number to call is 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Radio Show with host Josh Pick. Josh helps guide his clients through retirement by managing risk instead of chasing returns. He calls it a blueprint, and you can get started at no cost or obligation. Give the team at Aptus Wealth a call today to schedule your consultation at 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300 or online at aptuswealth.com. That's aptuswealth.com. To learn strategies to manage risk in the new economy, join us again next weekend right here at 98.9 The Answer. Any comments regarding safe and secure investments and guaranteed income streams refer only to fixed insurance products. They do not refer in any way to securities or investment advisory products. Fixed insurance and annuity product guarantees are subject to the claims-paying ability of the issuing company.